Honey, six of our kids are sick. Let's ask the neighbors if they'll read to two of them. In April of 1997, the president held a summit on voluntarism in Philadelphia. 15 million children are at risk in America, and the goal of the summit is to help 2 million of those vulnerable children by the year 2000. I understand the need for volunteers. I believe in the work of volunteers, and I support that work with my efforts. But for a government that has systematically dismantled programs that keep human desperation at bay for millions of people, to then produce a pep rally to get us all to volunteer each week to try to pick up the slack makes me tilt my head. If 15 million children are at risk in America, then it is 15 million American children we should commit ourselves to saving. Not 2 million in 4 years, but 15 million immediately. Incremental change is a classic tool of a status quo that is committed to no real change at all. There is no resource, governmental, economic, or private, that should not be involved in the effort to lift up America's desperate children and their parents who want to work. Private charity cannot compensate for governmental neglect and social injustice. And corporations throwing a few million dollars into the pot here and there is like you or me throwing a quarter to a homeless person on the street. If you bought this audiobook, I will receive money. Capitalism has been good to me. But there's no amount of money I can make that will protect my child from the explosion of horror that will occur in this country if we do not commit to a serious effort at universal access to the opportunities that capitalism affords. I made my own way, but as a child I was fed, stimulated culturally, safe in my environment, and cared for medically. I was told I was valuable by the world around me. Psychologically as well as materially, I had a reasonable chance of success. And it was not just my parents or our religious community that gave me those things. There was a larger culture of which I was part, believing in me and supporting me in myriad ways, large and small. In short, I was set up to succeed. But millions of American children today are absolutely set up to fail. Children cannot provide their own health care. Children cannot be responsible for their own education. Children cannot create their own cultural stimulation before someone teaches them how. To provide those things to all of America's children is our responsibility as a society dedicated to self-governance. It is one thing to say that everyone must climb the ladder of success by themselves. About that, I agree. But it is another thing altogether to make the bottom rung too high to reach for millions of our children. What are we thinking? Surely we are not in our right minds to abdicate our moral responsibility to the development of millions of American lives and then act horrified when they turn to dysfunctional behavior. We must awaken and act, not because we are fond of this group or that, but because we love America. Because we love the idea of democracy and social justice. Because we love our own children. President Kennedy, in his inaugural address, said, "The free society that does not take care of its many who are poor will not be able to save its few who are rich." Creating the alternative. We have to rethink money and its place in our lives if we are to transform American society. But the solution to economic injustice does not lie in making money bad. Spiritually, there is only one of us here. In the final analysis, there are no separate needs. Ultimately, what is good for Jesse Jackson is good for Rupert Murdoch. We do not have to choose between the rich and the poor, but only between a consciousness of abundance and a consciousness of lack. The primary political issue should not be the distribution of wealth, but the creation of wealth. That is why job training, job creation, and education matter so much. The creation of wealth should be validated, not undermined, but it must be validated for all American citizens. It is not a limited amount of wealth, but a limited amount of creative, compassionate thinking that is our problem as a nation. We need a new paradigm of understanding, a moral commitment to express it, and a new kind of activism to bring it forth. Yin Activism. In the May 19, 1997 issue of Time magazine, there's a major news story headlined, "Too Good to Be True. By almost any measure, life is swell in the U.S. What went right?" The article outlines the amazing string of wins that the United States has been enjoying for the last few years. We're breathing cleaner air and drinking cleaner water. Crime is in a free fall and near a 22-year low. and the U.S. economy keeps humming along beautifully. Skeptics like me are psychoanalyzed for our inability to take yes for an answer. You know, when I was a child, we were warned of the evils of communist propaganda, but capitalist propaganda doesn't seem to bother too many people. It's just called spin. The Time article quotes former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who served in President Clinton's first term, as saying, "There are still millions of people desperately trying to stay afloat, but Americans are segregated by income as never before, so it is far easier to pretend the worse off don't exist. They're out of sight." Then the article quotes a Clinton administration official as saying this is no time to talk about anything downbeat. There will be no return to Reichism, he said. That would shatter the public mood. Oh, wow. Thanks, guys. I feel much better. Glad you have our mood under control. I always felt that the Democrats whine a bit too much and that the Republicans are right to point out the benefits of optimism. But optimism is very different than denial. We are a country in denial. Like Germany in the early 30s, Rome before it fell, and France before the revolution, what we're experiencing is merely a sunset effect where the sun looks so glorious just before it goes down to inevitably darkening skies. The intention to heal. America has no dearth of genius. A routine trip to any shopping mall in America shows this. If we spent a fraction of the energy we now use to manufacture things we do not need, to instead create a society that truly works, we would be a completely different country. What we lack is an evolved sense of collective purpose for our talent and intelligence. Our awesome creativity is applied mainly to unimportant ends. Service shouldn't be something we do separate from our daily lives. It should become a way of life. That, at bottom, is what citizenship should be. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. It's something that Americans carry in our hearts much more than we do the promise of a balanced budget. What we most need as Americans is to remember, and then act on the memory, that we were born for something far more important than the attainment of mere self-centered goals. We were born to glorify the love of God. Renaissance politics. We need a new vortex of social energy in America, one that arises from the shared intention to heal our society. What this vortex will look like and how it will evolve in the material world is almost unimportant. The most powerful manifestations occur where yin precedes yang. To create a Renaissance politics in America, our first job is to create the thoughts and visions out of which new material structures will emerge. One of Taoism's highest principles is wu wei, non-resistance or non-action. But this is not at all a negative passivity. Quite to the contrary, what it means is that consciousness unburdened by material baggage has the greatest capacity to manifest a goal because it moves through life in a clear, clean line. As we transit from the material age into the consciousness age, we must address the realm of consciousness as seriously as we do action. Some might ask, if we're moving into an ideational era, why we need worldly institutions at all. They're necessary, in the words of Professor Houston Smith, to give an idea traction. Heaven is already perfect. It's earth we must improve. The key to doing this is to keep our minds on the thoughts of heaven while grounding our bodies to earth. The reunification of these two realms is the goal of human evolution. Politics is now dominated by negativity and discord in this country, and vessels of emotional and psychological violence have no capacity to bring forth peace. We ourselves must create an alternative political force that does. I call the inner work of creating this force yin activism. It is made up of three main elements: the awakening of our minds, atonement for our errors, and the arousal of our spirits. Personal power, repudiating mind death. The most critical political issue in America today is the numbing and suppression of personal power within the individual American citizen. We have been lulled to sleep by an official culture that speaks nonsense to us as though it were reasonable, and have been trained since childhood by a consumer culture to conspire in our own psychological bondage. The lullabies are compelling, but we must commit to our awakening. As we meditate and pray, we begin to awaken. As we read good books, we begin to awaken. As we eschew bad television, we begin to awaken. As we serve our community, we begin to awaken. As we journey toward psychological health, we begin to awaken. As we think for ourselves, we begin to awaken. As we communicate more freely, we begin to awaken. As we take up the philosophical mantle of concern for the future of life on Earth and apply it as best we can to our social, professional, and political endeavors, we begin to awaken ourselves and others. Mass awakening from our entrenched delusions is the only hope for America's healing. Expanding our concept of love. When Americans are in a crisis, we come together and work together magnificently. What is happening now is that we are denying that there's a crisis and are pretending things are all rosy. For those of us who believe there's at least as much danger in the denial as in the crisis itself, the challenge is to come together anyway. All strength is found in joining. But this time we must see the joining as more than an answer to a particular problem. We must see it as the crux of the new politics. We must see the joining as the necessary next step in our cultural evolution. We must consider what it means to join and indeed what it means to love. Romantic love is a wonderful thing, great for skin tone, but it is not the spiritual height of love, and the country must outgrow our false attachment to it if we are to heal. We are being beckoned by a higher love. We are being challenged by destiny to move beyond eros or romantic love, beyond even philia or love for friends, to the agape of love for all humankind. The love of which I speak is not made up of denial, enabling, or false posturing. It cries as often as it laughs. It admits of sadness and despair. There's nothing smarmy about it. It is not a less authentic, but rather a more authentic mode of human thought and behavior. Invalidating it on the grounds that it is touchy-feely is preposterous. We must free the subject of love from the mental prison where it has been relegated by our pseudo-sophisticated bias. We must eschew the tacit injunction against its discussion in any other context but the romantic or the mundane. We are quickly coming upon an age when the question of what it means to love will define our science, our educational systems, indeed, our politics. As the philosopher Pierre Teilhard de Chardin said, "Someday, after we have mastered the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness for God the energies of love. Then, for the second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire." Now we'll move from the first aspect of yin activism, awakening the spirit, to the second aspect, atonement for our errors. This is not a time in America to minimize our antagonisms or pretend they don't exist. This is a time for serious people to try, with depth of intelligence and heart, to build new bridges. The most important reconciliation needed in America today is in the area of race. With a nation as with an individual, amends are necessary to free the psyche and allow it to move on. Atonement is part of spiritual law, built into human consciousness as part of the divine response to error. It is our opportunity to interrupt the law of cause and effect, which otherwise holds absolute sway. Grace supersedes the law of karma. To atone is to admit our errors and ask God to free us from their consequences. In order to achieve this freedom, we must willingly and consciously unburden ourselves of the weight of our mistakes, asking God for the chance to begin again, to go forward in life from a healed perspective. America's denial of our own violations of the principles at the core of the American ideal limits our capacity for renaissance. God will grant us new life, but only when we are willing to renounce our errors. He will not take from us what we do not consciously and willingly give back to Him. As long as dark, loveless thinking remains in our minds, it will have negative effects on our lives. There are three main areas where America's need to atone weighs greatly on our collective psyche: our cruel treatment, indeed genocide, toward Native American peoples, our racism toward African Americans throughout our history, and the terrible mistake that was the war in Vietnam. Dances with death. Native Americans had lived on this continent for 1,000 generations before Europeans discovered it. The wisdom of the indigenous peoples of North America graced this soil for centuries before the white intruders arrived. In 1492, it is estimated that anywhere from 10 to 25 million indigenous people lived north of Mexico. Within 150 years, as a result of war and disease, there were fewer than a million Indians left here alive. Part of the irony of the devastation of the Native American population by white expansion is that the Western world is now near the brink of global disaster because we lack contact with the very quality of consciousness that so many of the Indian peoples personified. We killed them, and now we need them. How much better off America would be today had our ancestors been wise enough to take advantage on a mass level of the extraordinary opportunity presented to them to marry European and Native American cultures. Blood stays on our hands unto endless generations, and only atonement washes them clean. One thing we could do in America to materially express our desire for healing the relationship with Native Americans would be to repeal Columbus Day. Christopher Columbus, for all the fiction created around him, was a murderer of indigenous peoples. Given the fact that his life was a model for the standard of enslavement and killing that came to characterize much of European settlement in the New World, to honor him is deeply insulting to Native Americans. Moreover, it stunts the collective psyche of the nation that we are so dishonest about our history. In 1992, at the time of the quincentennial celebration of his Discovery of America, there was a national rethinking of Columbus's appropriate place in history. The National Council of Churches, the largest ecumenical body in the United States, called on Christians to refrain from celebrating the quincentennial, saying, "What represented newness of freedom, hope, and opportunity for some was the occasion for oppression, degradation, and genocide for others. When it comes to celebrating Columbus or Columbus Day, we should just say no." I've heard people acknowledge that Columbus himself poses a problem, yet they wouldn't want to give up Columbus Day as a holiday because it celebrates the contribution of Italians to American civilization. If what we're excited about, and indeed we should be, is how many people from other lands have enriched America, then perhaps we could change Columbus Day to Immigrants Day. I realize how many people would not want that, of course, but that is all the more reason why we should propose it. Colorblind like hell. The United States is like a torch that has at various times both enlightened the world and burned the world. We should be the generation that commits to making right what still needs to be made right in order that our children might have a fresh page on which to write their story. A story very much alive in America is the tortured relationship between blacks and whites. For this, atonement is only the beginning of what is morally demanded of us. We have begun the path to true justice for the African American, but we have not yet completed it. If we do not do that now, this country will face a terrible consequence. While the Civil War could end an evil institution, it could not end evil thinking. In abolishing slavery, we did not abolish racism. Indeed, such societies as the Ku Klux Klan were founded after the end of the Civil War in direct response to the abolition of slavery. While external legislative remedies are an aid to racial healing, spiritual forces are necessary to heal the terrible wounds to the heart and soul. Cellular memory of hatred and abuse has accumulated among black Americans to such an extent that it has become a generational resentment, leaving only two choices on the road ahead. The relationship between our races will turn to violence unless it turns to love. White America must acknowledge its culpability in institutionalizing racism, including a formalized amends to the African American people, and black Americans must have deep and serious permission to voice its frustrations in a dignified way, one that honors the depth of injury and insult to African American people throughout our history. I do not believe the average American is racist, but I believe the average American does not truly realize how racist our public policies are. 1 in 3 black Americans lives in poverty, 3 times the rate of whites. 1/2 of all black children in America live in poverty. Unemployment for African Americans is twice as high as it is for whites and has been for the last 30 years. For the same educational background, blacks can expect to make 82 to 86% of the income of whites. On May 16, 1997, President Clinton offered a public apology on behalf of the nation to the victims of the federal government's Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, an infamous chapter in the history of American medical research. In that study, starting in 1932, 399 indigent black men from Tuskegee, Alabama, were told that they would receive free medical treatment for syphilis, but instead were left untreated and carefully monitored. Even after penicillin was found to be a successful cure in the mid-1940s, the men were left untreated. To our African-American citizens, I'm sorry that your federal government orchestrated a study so clearly racist, said the president. The government, said President Clinton, did something that was wrong, deeply, profoundly, morally wrong. It was an outrage to our commitment to integrity and equality for all citizens. It is very heartening to hear the president make that statement, but it is also very important that we not use our apologies for specific instances of racism to help us ignore the all-pervasiveness of racism in our society. It is not enough to treat the symptoms of racism. We must treat the disease itself. Tuskegee was part of a larger pattern of abuse that stemmed from a general feeling that the lives of black people do not deserve the same respect and consideration as the lives of white people. President Clinton's action was a good beginning, nothing more and nothing less. We need rituals of atonement and apology for American racism, past and present. Racial atonement. The nation now debates whether or not Congress should officially apologize for slavery. For those Americans who think that blacks need to just forgive slavery and move on with their lives, I would like to point out that it is much easier to forgive someone when they have had the courtesy to apologize. The apology is the yin we need. Serious restitution is the yang. When African Americans say the word reparations, you would think they had suggested something completely outrageous. But the concept is legitimate. Germany paid somewhere around $50 billion in restitution to Jews after World War II. The United States paid $20,000 to every Japanese American who had been sent to concentration camps here in America during World War II. Nothing short of a massive investment in America's poor black population, the true legacy of slavery, is a responsible sign of America's willingness to heal itself racially. Money will not solve America's problems. Only spiritual power will do that. But spiritual power is not released in the absence of serious intent and sincerity. It is neither serious nor sincere to apologize, but not to back up the apology with action where action is appropriate. According to A Course in Miracles, the holiest of all the spots on earth is where an ancient hatred has become a present love. Let us imagine the glory that could be and pray to bring it forth. I have participated in atonement prayers throughout the country, with whites collectively apologizing to blacks. The experience for both groups can be extremely powerful. And he was good enough to mention it on his book tour. Robert McNamara, who was President Johnson's Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, has written in his memoirs that the war was a quote-unquote terrible mistake. After hearing that, if we were an enlightened society, we would have all gone to bed for 3 days. We would have cried, moaned, gotten sick, screamed it out, punched punching bags, done whatever it would take to get the pain up and out of ourselves. There is an inestimable human tragedy stuck to this nation as a result of that war, a significant aspect of which is the ever more frayed bond of trust between the American people and their government. The Vietnam War Memorial is a uniquely powerful place because it is emotionally true. It doesn't lie. It pictures the war as a huge black gash across our landscape, which it is. It appropriately memorializes the lives of those who died such purposeless, tragic deaths in Vietnam, and it helps us grieve not only for them, but also for who we were as a nation before that war so wounded us. We still have not opened ourselves collectively to the shame and horror of that huge mistake. We have not atoned to our vets, to their families, to God, to other nations involved, or to ourselves. Until we do, we shall remain in some way under the effect of that mistake. Even worse, we will continue to repeat it. America is still weighed down by the mass of our unprocessed guilt and the sickness of our secrets. Ever since the 60s, America has been besieged by lurking shadows. You cannot dedicate a nation to the high ideals to which this one was dedicated and not expect the soul to rebel in some way when you start acting like you didn't really mean it. From the genocide of Native Americans, to our systemic racism, to the Vietnam War, the United States needs, as they say in the 12-step recovery program, to take a fearless moral inventory. We are not to spend the rest of our lives in an endless string of mea culpas, but as soon as we say at least a few sincere ones, the miracle of atonement will begin to release our collective soul. Finally, we'll talk about the third aspect of yin activism, the arousal of spirit. American society has developed in such a way as to keep spiritual seeking in the private domain. There is a level at which this bias is appropriate, and a level at which it is not. While the separation of church and state is an important and enlightened concept, it has been at times strangely interpreted. It is damaging to America, not liberating, that soulful spiritual dialogue has been relegated to the margins of our cultural conversation. For centuries, the church held indomitable sway over the thinking of the Western world, often abusing its influence in such a way as to suppress legitimate rational investigation of the universe in which we live. In the modern era, a fashionable cynicism that opposes any kind of faith has become the new intellectual tyranny in American society. Often, even the most legitimate religious and mystical paths are invalidated in a way no less oppressive than how science was suppressed in earlier days. The status quo seeks to trivialize and diminish the efforts of almost anyone seeking to bring spiritual principles and depth psychology into the cultural mainstream. The press has led the charge, but I sense that we're on the verge of a sea change, for a critical mass has gathered around the new frontiers of knowledge. As German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer said, "Whenever a new truth enters the world, the first stage of reaction to it is ridicule. The second stage is violent opposition. And in the third stage, that truth comes to be regarded as self-evident." The creative challenge of spiritual life is to know enough about the world to be informed and enough about God to be hopeful. From Jesus to Buddha to Moses to Muhammad, wayshowers have risen out of the timeline of history to draw maps and pave roads to a more perfect world. From Jefferson to Lincoln to Gandhi to King, world leaders have injected into history the political principles of higher awareness. If we ourselves follow as best we can, applying eternal truths to our own historical circumstances and bringing forth even a fraction of their power, then we will be a generation that does much to repair the world. None of us know, all of us know. A healthy skepticism regarding the government's official posture on an issue is essential to our freedom. In the late 60s, millions of Americans who protested against the Vietnam War wouldn't have dreamed of believing something just because the Pentagon said it. Now, however, we live at a time when TWA Flight 800, en route from New York's JFK Airport to Paris, explodes inexplicably in the air, and all rumors of accidental release or friendly fire from the U.S. military trying out a new defense system in the area are struck down fairly easily. We're supposed to scoff at anyone silly enough to buy into the notion that TWA 800 came down because of friendly fire, yet on February 6, 1997, a chartered jet landing at JFK in New York had to take sudden evasive action so as not to collide with two New Jersey National Guard F-16s that had erroneously been cleared by the Navy to fly in that airspace. When the television program 60 Minutes got hold of a swatch of material from a seat in Flight 800's cabin, purportedly covered with missile fuel, the swatch was confiscated by the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB. The NTSB says the real issue with Flight 800 had to do with a problem in the center fuel tank of the 747. This theory is reasonable. The NTSB claims the disaster was an accident that could have been prevented had the Federal Aviation Administration followed the board's recommendation regarding the installation of a corrective feature to the tank mechanism. That recommendation has not been followed, according to FAA officials, because the cost analysis doesn't measure up. They put a price of somewhere around $2.8 million on the head of every human being. And since making the correction would cost more than the figure tallied up if you calculated how many people would be flying in 747s, the airline industry decided not to make the correction. People don't even pretend anymore.
You'd think FAA officials would say something like, of course, no human life could ever be measured in terms of dollars and cents, but... But the dominant ethos in America today allows people to just say what they're really thinking. An FAA official put it this way, every human life has its price. So we have two choices. Either Flight 800 came down because a Navy missile accidentally hit it and there's a huge government cover-up, or Flight 800 came down because money is put before our safety. Either way, are you happy? A country is like a huge family system. One of the most potent psychological factors in that system is family secrets. Mommy and Daddy say everything is fine, but little Johnny is cutting his wrists, and little Gloria hasn't eaten in months. What are Mommy and Daddy not facing? Privacy and discretion among individuals are positive things, but undue official secrecy is negative. Truth heals, secrets destroy. With the establishment of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, those who perpetrated crimes under the rule of apartheid are now given amnesty in exchange for admitting the truth. It is officially acknowledged that getting the facts out is necessary to that country's healing process. This is not some New Age slobber. In fact, if anything, the tendency of so many Americans to self-indulgently reveal too much of their personal stories today, and of the press to dig so rudely and inappropriately into people's personal affairs, is an unconscious effort to get to a level of truth that we all feel is missing. We itch in one place and scratch in another. The rules of psychology and group dynamics apply to our entire nation, and increasingly they affect our political behavior. I have no idea what brought down Flight 800 any more than anyone else does. But I know this. People have gut feelings, and the American gut is still very tense about that crash, as it is still tense about the Kennedy and King assassinations, indeed about almost everything related to official explanations over the last 30 years. That tension is at the root of our group malaise. We are cynical, but we did not start out that way. We began with what is basically a healthy skepticism on the part of free and sovereign people, but the system that was devised to be a two-way street between citizen questions and government answers became monopolized by official PR blasts. The average citizen doesn't know where to direct our questions anymore, much less our outrage. So we pretend we don't care or that someone else is going to fix things, which fits perfectly into their plans, whoever they are. The myth of the powerful white male. White men constitute 33% of the U.S. population, but 80% of the members of the House of Representatives and 90% of the U.S. Senate. At 33% of the population, why aren't they considered a special interest group? They're just a piece of the fabric that makes up this country, no better or worse than the rest of us. They don't always think the way women do or blacks do, or any of the other groups who live with them in this country, which supposedly belongs to all of us. It's not just that all of our needs need to be represented in a democracy. How we all think needs to be represented in a democracy. The way it is now, one group gets away with calling any other kind of thinking less serious than its own. The military is a perfect example of why men shouldn't run everything. The military is a phallic fantasy. It's an archetypal role for men to see a phallic image and say, wow, this thing is wonderful, and an archetypal role for women to say, maybe yes, maybe no. It depends on what you do with it. American women shouldn't spend so much time fighting for the right to fight in the military, so much as fighting for a say in what we do with the military, and what we do with our congressional budget, and what we do with our children's lives. The same denial-based mentality that looks the other way rather than deeply question the presence of military aircraft in civilian airspace also looks the other way rather than question our national priorities. Women, and men as well, must find a way to break the chain of codependent acquiescence to patriarchal ideas when they are dangerous for our children and the future of the world. I realize that some men are more feminist than some women, and that some women are more patriarchal in their thinking than some men. I do not think women are necessarily less violent than men, but I do think women are generally more relationship-based than men are, and obviously tend to live closer to the children. We can see with our eyes and avoid less easily the sight of children's bodies and souls as they fall apart from lack of care. As women, we need to do more than just enter the halls of financial or governmental power. We must do something much more difficult than that. We must change things once we get there. Feminism is a failure, if ultimately all it means is that women have the same right to worldly power as men have. The higher significance of power is not the struggle to attain it, but rather what we do with it. The Western world is having an identity crisis, striving to balance itself after centuries of patriarchal leanings. Many men are joining women in leading the way to a more balanced consciousness and a fairer society. They're finding, among other things, their silence. Women must find, among other things, our voices. The children need us. Every once in a while, I see an article about unpaid women's work. If babysitting, cooking, driving the kids here and there, and so on, were counted for their financial equivalency, how much of the nation's productivity would come from women? Viewed this way, our earnings would add up to more than men's. But even that doesn't begin to tell the story. During that drive to the roller skating rink, the 2 5-year-olds in the back seat ask questions that demand an extraordinary amount of sophisticated understanding and emotional mettle in order to answer well. Some of those hours shouldn't be considered worth $6.50 an hour for a babysitter, but more like $100 an hour for a child psychologist. Guiding one young person through adolescence in America today is not just equivalent to a $10 or $15 an hour job. It is a job that demands a wisdom and fortitude that make being a lawyer look like small potatoes. Notice how economics works. It is based not on some inherent value in a product, but rather on the value we place on the product. The ultimate economic issue, then, is not value, but values. We place far too little value on things having to do with childhood and the care of children. As a consequence, we underinvest enormously in our children, costing us tremendously on the other end in everything from health care to drugs to crime. Raising a child is not just the most important job in society. It takes much greater skill than most. American culture patronizes its parents, teachers, and other child care professionals, throwing on the verbal support ad nauseum, but withholding financial and material support, such as child care, health insurance, tax breaks, and educational funds. Make no mistake, the affluent can avoid America's major problems, and increasingly we do. Our children can go to private schools, therefore we don't have to face the woes and undue strain on the public educational system every day. We can shop at specialty food stores and avoid the dangerous health abuses, such as high levels of hormones allowed in our meat and milk, present in common American food products. We can and do hire private police and security forces to protect us from the violence in our society, and our elected officials have effectively removed the most harrowing signs of mass despair from our vision. Political awareness will not knock on your door in America today. You have to consciously and willingly invite it in. Drugs, sobriety, and magic. A system that makes a lot of noise about fighting drugs is itself invested in our being stoned. A critical mass of clear thinkers is the one thing that would change this country. We sometimes spend a lot of money trying to fight a problem, merely masking the fact that we have no intention of solving it. While our politicians are big on discussing America's drug problem, they hardly ever discuss sobriety. There's a reason for this. Sobriety doesn't yet play a serious part in mainstream conversation because America hasn't yet decided to become sober. The most significant drug stash in America is in our collective medicine chests. America has become a legally ordained drug culture. America's overmedication of itself and its children is our biggest dirty little secret. Notice how illegal drugs are called drugs, but legal drugs are called medication. So-and-so thinks I should go on medication has replaced what we used to say in the old days. Do you know where I can get a gram? The kid's a problem? Attention deficit disorder? Put him on Ritalin. Can't deal with the pressure of work and home? Prozac might be the answer. I'm not saying that there are never legitimate reasons for psychiatric drugs, because clearly there are. But the bigger issue is America's hypocrisy in not facing up to our addictive patterns, preferring to suppress the symptoms rather than legitimately deal with our pain. We have allowed billion-dollar industries to grow up around ways to manage and suppress our misery. Psychologist Carl Jung said, "All neurosis is a substitute for legitimate suffering." As a culture, America lacks a deep understanding of the value of suffering. Contrary to popular opinion, there are times when allowing ourselves to suffer is the only way to get through the pain. The fact that so many of us endure deep psychic pain on a daily basis should be something more significant than a gold mine for drug manufacturers. It should be the source of deep questioning about what has gone so wrong and the embrace of real solutions like maybe a serious spiritual life. Why is a pharmaceutical company that makes billions of dollars manufacturing antidepressants called a legitimate capitalist concern, but someone who suggests that we pray and meditate regularly to help treat depression liable to be called a snake oil salesman? Americans don't need to treat our unhappiness so much as we need to respond to our unhappiness. It is here for a reason. It is trying to tell us something. It is a sign that who we have been in our lives and what we have been doing with our lives is an inadequate structure for the energies trying to emerge within us. If we were intent on fighting drugs in this country, we would seriously foster recovery. We would have 12-step recovery meetings in the high schools during the afternoons. A recovery channel is starting to broadcast on television soon. For a fraction of the money we spend fighting drugs, we could have federally funded such a network years ago. And most important, we should begin asking ourselves, what is the hole inside our children and inside us that we are all seeking to fill so dysfunctionally? What is it about the world we have created for ourselves that we so don't want to be here? Our drug war should be replaced by a national sobriety campaign, and that means a whole lot more than just saying no. It means saying yes to some things that America, deep in its heart, has not yet decided it wants to say yes to. Notice we have a drug czar, but not a sobriety czar. It's as though our government is run by a group of old-fashioned father figures who rarely spend any time at home, but then love to come into the house and start giving orders. The kids look at him like he's crazy. Who's done more to get America off drugs, Gerald Ford or Betty Ford? The only way America is going to solve its drug problem is if we retrieve our spiritual awareness. That is what sobriety is. There is a magic within each of us that we consistently deny because it lies in the realm of the imagination. We have been trained since childhood to view the imagination as a less important function than the intellect. This has left us emotionally and spiritually bereft. Taking drugs is a desperate effort to compensate for the loss. The most dangerous thing in the world for a free society is for a critical mass of people to lose conscious contact with the place within us that says, "Hey, something's fishy here. I feel something rotten in my gut." Not everything that is happening in America today would make a person who is in their right mind happy. That's why we should be in our right minds. Our right minds are our salvation. Magic people. What do so many of us wish to bring back to civilized awareness in a more potent, alive way? Mystery, intuition, ritual, relationship, healing, emotion, soul, community, imagination. Important parts of who we all are, the stuff of magic and magical people. The peoples who have never dropped those things from the forefront of their consciousness are the peoples who have lived at the margins of power in Western civilization during the era now drawing to a close. They have been suppressed at the deepest level, not because the prevailing patriarchal consciousness thought they were less than. They were repressed because unconsciously it was suspected that they were more than. All people, through the grace of God, have mystical power greatly underutilized in this now passing millennium. But it is people who have been historically held down, whose inner strengths have been simmering within the pressure cooker of their profound long-suffering, who now stand at the forefront of humanity's rebirth. The magic people haven't been invited to attend the party in America for fear that they might dance. They haven't been invited to speak at the party for fear that they might sing. They haven't been invited to run the party for fear that they might change it. They would have, and now they're going to. Holistic politics. Beyond the appearances of history, there is a great and glorious unfolding plan for the destiny of nations. God carries the plan within his mind and seeks always in all ways channels for its furtherance. His plan for humanity and the preparation of teachers to guide it is called within the esoteric traditions the Great Work. When a particular group or structure fails to keep faith with God, not measured by its words but by its actions, that structure then loses the privilege of guardianship of the Great Work. The plan passes on to other groups or structures. Human beings cannot stop or pervert the works of destiny, but we can dissociate ourselves from its higher unfoldment. When we do, we cease to share in its blessings.